with him a silver ballpoint pen. He repeated the names and details.
"I tell you what," said Fallow. "I'm going to call the city desk straight away."
He got up and caromed off a chair at the next table where an old woman in a Chanel-style suit was trying to lift a spoonful of sorrel soup to her mouth. She glared at him.
"What do you want to eat?" said Vogel. "I'll order for you."
"Nothing. A bowl of tomato soup, some chicken paillard."
"Some wine?"
"No. Well, just a glass."
The coin telephone was in a vestibule across from the hat check room, where a pretty girl sat on a high stool reading a book. Her eyes peeked out from a sinister black ellipse, carefully drawn around her eyelids. Fallow rang up Frank DiPietro, the city editor of the City Light. DiPietro was one of the few Americans in an important editorial position on the newspaper. They needed someone from New York as city editor. The other Englishmen who worked there, like Fallow himself, were acquainted with a single stretch of Manhattan from the trendy restaurants in Tribeca on the south to the trendy restaurants in Yorkville, near 86th Street, on the north. The rest of New York might as well have been Damascus.
"Yeah?"
The voice of Frank DiPietro. His enthusiasm over having a call from Peter Fallow at a busy time of the day was imperceptible.
"Frank," said Fallow, "are you familiar with a place called the Edgar Allan Poe Projects?"
"Yeah." "Are you?"
Fallow didn't know which was more unpleasant, this Yank habit of saying yeah for yes or the incredulity in the man's voice. Nevertheless, he plowed on, telling Albert Vogel's story with embellishments, where needed, and with no mention of Albert Vogel. He left the impression that he had already been in touch with Reverend Bacon and the victim's mother, and that his imminent appearance in the Bronx was awaited by one and all. DiPietro told him to go ahead and check it out. This he did with no particular enthusiasm either, and yet Fallow felt his heart fill with a quite unexpected joy. When he returned to the table, Vogel said,
"Hey, I'll go. Your soup's getting cold."
The words barely made it out of his mouth, which was crammed full of food. A large bowl of tomato soup and a glass of white wine were at Fallow's place. Vogel was busy working on a hideous-looking joint of veal.
"They like it, huh?"
Well, they don't despise it," thought Fallow. His nausea began withdrawing. The yolk grew smaller. A crisp exhilaration, not unlike that of an athlete entering the fray, stole into his nervous system. He felt almost clean. It was the emotion, never commented upon by the poets, enjoyed by those who feel that, for once, they are earning their pay. It was Kramer's turn to wear the beeper on his waistband for 12 hours. In the Homicide Bureau of the Bronx District Attorney's Office, somebody, some assistant district attorney, was on call at all times. The purpose was to have someone to go to crime scenes immediately, to interview witnesses before they vanished or lost the urge to talk about the mayhem. For those 12 hours, an assistant DA was likely to get stuck with every piece of shit in the Bronx that involved a homicide, and it was a classic Bronx piece of shit that had brought Kramer here to this precinct house. A black detective sergeant named Gordon was standing near the booking desk, giving him the details.
"They called a guy Pimp," said Gordon, "but he's not a pimp. He's a gambler, mainly, and he probably does some dealing in drugs, but he dresses like a pimp. You'll see him in a minute. He's back there in the locker room, wearing some kind of trick suit with a double-breasted vest."
Gordon shook his head.
"He's sitting on the edge of a chair, eating ribs, holding them like this."
He leaned forward and raised his hand in a dainty gesture.
"So the sauce won't get on a suit. He had about 40 suits, and when he tells you about those fucking suits, you'll think it was his fucking child that's missing."
The whole thing had happened because someone had stolen the 40 suits. Oh, this was a real piece of shit. Waves and waves of childishness and pointless violence, and Kramer hadn't even heard the whole story yet. The main room of the precinct was saturated with the dank and oddly sweet smell of rotting wood, caused by decades of steam radiators leaking onto the floors. Most of the floor had been replaced with concrete. The walls were painted government work green, except for an old battered tongue-and-groove wainscoting, 3 feet high around the bottom. The building had thick walls and high ceilings, now overgrown with trays of fluorescent lights. Across the way, Kramer could see the backs of the two patrolmen. Their hips were enormous with weaponry and paraphernalia, including flashlights, summons books, walkie-talkies, and handcuffs. One of them kept lifting his hands in explanatory gestures to two women and a man, local residents, whose faces said they didn't believe a word of it. Gordon was telling Kramer,
"So he's in this apartment, and there's four guys in there, and one of them is his Andre Potts, who he figures knows who took the suits. Only Andre says he don't know nothing from nothing. And they're going back and forth, and finally Andre's had enough of this, and he gets up and walks out of the room. And so what would you do if some disrespectful sucker got up and turned his back on you while you're inquiring about your fucking 40 suits? You'd shoot him in the back, right? So that's what Pimp did. He shot Mr. Andre Potts in the back 3 times with a 38.
"You got witnesses?" asked Kramer.
"Oh, we got 'em stacked up."
At that moment, the beeper went off on Kramer's waistband. "Can I use your phone?" Gordon motioned toward an open door that led into the detective bureau, which was an office off the main room. Inside were 3 dismal, government-work gray metal desks. At each desk sat a black man in his 30s or 40s. Each had on Bronx street garb, a bit too funky to be true. Kramer thought of how unusual it was to come across an entire bureau made up of black detectives. The one at the desk nearest the door wore a black thermal vest and a sleeveless black T-shirt that showed off his powerful arms. Kramer reached toward the telephone on his desk and said, "Use your phone."
"Hey, what the fuck, man?"
Kramer pulled his hand back.
"How long I gotta sit here chained up like a fucking animal?"
With that, the man raised his powerful left arm with a terrific clattering. There was a manacle on his wrist, and from the manacle, a chain. The other end of the chain was manacled to the leg of the desk. Now the other two at the other desks had their arms up in the air, clattering and yammering. All 3 of them were chained to the desks.
"All I did was see the motherfucker whack that sucker, and he was the motherfucker that whacked that sucker, and I'm the one you got chained up like a fucking animal, and that motherfucker..."
Another terrific clatter as he gestured toward a room in the rear with his left hand.
"He's sitting back there watching fucking TV and eating ribs."
Kramer looked to the back of the room, and sure enough, back there in a locker room was a figure sitting on the edge of a chair lit by the hectic flush of the television set and eating a length of barbecued rib of pork. And he was, indeed, leaning forward daintily. The sleeve of his jacket was tailored to show a lot of white cuff and gleaming cuff link. Now all 3 were yammering, "Fucking ribs, fucking chains, fucking TV!" But of course, the witnesses. Once Kramer realized that, everything, chains and all, fell into place.
"Yeah, okay, okay," he said to the man in an impatient fashion. "I'll take care of you in a minute. I gotta make a phone call. Fucking ribs, cheer! Fucking chains!"
Kramer called the office, and Gloria, Bernie Fitzgibbon's secretary, said Milt Lovell wanted to talk to him. Lovell was Abe Weiss's press secretary. Kramer barely knew Lovell. He couldn't remember talking to him more than 4 or 5 times. Gloria gave him Lovell's number. Milt Lovell had worked on the old New York Mirror, back when Walter Winchell still had his column. He had known the great man ever so slightly and had carried his breathless, snap-brim way of talking onward into the last days of the 20th century.
"Kramer," he said. "Kramer, Kramer, let me see, Kramer. Yeah, 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 okay, I got it. The case of Henry Lamb, likely to die. What's it amount to?"
"It's a piece of shit," said Kramer.
"Well, I got a query from the City Light, some Brit named Fallow. Guy's got this accent. I thought I was listening to Channel 13. Anyway, he's reading me a statement from Reverend Bacon about the case of Henry Lamb. That's all I need. The words of Reverend Reginald Bacon in a British accent. You know Bacon?"
"Yeah," said Kramer. "I interviewed Henry Lamb's mother in Bacon's office.
This guy has something from her, too, but mainly it's Bacon. Let me see, let me see, let me see. It says, blah, 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 human life in the Bronx, malfeasance, white middle class, blah, 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 nuclear magnetic resonance, goes on about the nuclear magnetic resonance. There's maybe 2 of the fucking machines in the whole country, I think, blah, blah, blah. Let me see, here it is. He accuses the district attorney of dragging his feet. We won't go to the trouble of proceeding with the case because the kid is a black youth from the Poe Projects and is too much trouble.
That's bullshit.
Well, I know that, and you know that, but I gotta call this Brit back and tell him something.
A tremendous clatter.
How long I gotta sit here in these chains, man?
The man with the big arms was erupting again.
This is against the law!
Hey, said Kramer, genuinely annoyed. You want to get out of here, you'll knock it off. I can't fucking hear myself talk. Then to Lovell. Sorry, I'm over at the precinct. He wrapped his hand around his mouth and the mouthpiece of the telephone and said in a low voice, They got 3 homicide witnesses over here chained to the fucking desk legs in the detective bureau, and they're going bananas. He enjoyed the low-level macho jolt of trotting out this little war story for Lovell, even though he didn't even know the man.
The desk legs, said Lovell with an appreciative note. Jesus Christ, that I never heard of.
Anyway, said Kramer, where was I? Okay, we got a Mercedes-Benz with a license plate beginning with R. For a start, we don't even know if we're talking about a New York State license plate, okay? That's for a start, but let's suppose we are. There's 2,500 Mercedes registered in New York State with license plates starting with R. Okay? Now, the second letter supposedly looks like an E or an F or maybe a P or a B or an R. Some letter with a vertical on the left and some horizontals going off of it. Suppose we go with that. We're still talking about almost 500 cars.
So what do you do? Go after 500 cars?
If you have a witness who can tell you the boy was hit by such a car, maybe you do. But there's no witness except for the kid, and he's in a coma and isn't coming out. We got no information about a driver. All we have is 2 people in a car, 2 white people, a man and a woman, and on top of that, the kid's story don't add up in the first place.
Well, what do I say? The investigation is continuing?
Yeah, the investigation is continuing. But unless Martin finds a witness, there's no case here. Even if the kid was hit by a car, it probably wasn't the kind of collision that would yield forensic evidence from the car, because the kid don't have the bodily injuries that are consistent with such a collision. I mean, for Christ's sake, there are so many fucking ifs in this cockamamie story. If you ask me, it's a piece of shit. The kid seems like a decent sort, and so does his mother, but between you and me, I think he got in some kind of scrape and made up this bullshit story to tell his mother.
Well then, why would he dream up part of a license plate? Why wouldn't he say he didn't get the number?
How do I know? Why does anybody do anything that they do in this county? You think this guy, this reporter, is actually going to write something?
I don't know. I'm just going to say that naturally we're following the thing closely.
Anybody else called you about it?
Nah, it sounds like Bacon reached this guy some way.
What does Bacon get out of it?
Oh, this is one of the hobby horses he rides. The double standard, white justice, blah, blah, blah. He's always out to embarrass the mayor.
Well, said Kramer, if he can make something out of this piece of shit, then he's a magician. By the time Kramer hung up, the 3 shackled witnesses were clattering and complaining again. With a heavy heart, he realized he was actually going to have to sit down and talk to these 3 germs and get something coherent out of them about a man named Pimp who shot a man who knew a man who may or may not have known the whereabouts of 40 suits. His entire Friday night was going to get shot in the ass, and he would have to shoot dice with fate and ride the subway back down to Manhattan. He looked back into the locker room once more. That very vision himself, that gentleman's quarterly cover boy, the man named Pimp, was still back there, eating ribs and hugely enjoying something on the TV, which lit up his face in tones of first-degree burn pink and cobalt therapy blue. Kramer stepped outside the detective bureau and said to Gordon, "Your witnesses are getting kind of restless in there. That one guy wants to wrap his chain around my throat."
"I had to put a chain on him."
"I know that, but let me ask you something. This fella Pimp, he's just sitting back there eating ribs. He's not chained to anything."
"Oh, I'm not worried about Pimp. He's not going anywhere. He's cooling out. He's contented. This crummy neighborhood is all he knows. I bet he don't know New York is on the Atlantic Ocean. He's a homeboy. No, he's not going anywhere. He's only the perpetrator. But a witness. Hey, baby, if I didn't put the chain on the witness, you wouldn't have nobody to interview. You'd never see his ass again. A fucking witness will cut out for Santo Domingo faster than you can say off-peak fare."
Kramer headed back to the detective bureau to do his duty and interview the 3 irate citizens in chains and try to find some order in this latest piece of shit. Since the City Light published no Sunday newspaper, there was only a skeleton crew in the city room on Saturday afternoons. Most of them were wire-copy editors, scavenging through the material that continued to come stuttering and shuddering out of the Associated Press and United Press International machines for items that might be of use for Monday's edition. There were three reporters in the city room, plus one down at Manhattan's Central Police Headquarters, in case there occurred some catastrophe or piece of mayhem so gory that the City Light's readers would still want to lap it up on Monday. There was a lone assistant city editor, who spent most of the afternoon on the telephone, making sales calls on the City Light's Watts line for a sideline of his, which was selling college fraternity jewelry wholesale to fraternity house managers who sold the stuff, the tie tacks and rings and pledge pins and whatnot, to the brothers at retail and kept the difference for themselves. The boredom and lassitude of these sentinels of the press could scarcely be exaggerated. And on this particular Saturday afternoon, there was also Peter Fallow. Fallow, by contrast, was fervor personified. Of the various cubicles around the edges of the city room, his was the only one in use. He was perched on the edge of his chair, with the telephone at his ear and a biro in his hand. He was so keyed up, his excitement cut through today's hangover with something approaching clarity. On his desk was a telephone directory for Nassau County, which was on Long Island. A great hefty thing it was, this directory. He had never heard of Nassau County, although he now reckoned he must have passed through it during the weekend when he had managed to inspire St. John's Superior at the museum, Virgil Gooch III. The Yanks loved to string Roman numerals after their sons' names, to invite him to his ludicrously grand house by the ocean in East Hampton, Long Island. There was no second invitation, but, ah well. As for the town of Hewlett, which was in the county of Nassau, its existence on the face of the earth was news to him, but somewhere in the town of Hewlett a telephone was ringing, and he desperately wanted it to be answered. Finally, after seven rings, it was.
"Hello?"
Out of breath.
"Mr. Rifkin?"
"Yes?" Out of breath and wary.
"This is Peter Fallow of the New York City Light."
"Don't want any."
"Excuse me?" "I do hope you'll forgive me for ringing you up on a Saturday afternoon."
"You hope wrong. I subscribed to the Times once, actually got it about once a week."
No, I'm not.
Either somebody swiped it from the front door before I left the house, or it was soaking wet, or it was never delivered."
"No, I'm a journalist, Mr. Rifkin. I write for the City Light."
He finally managed to establish this fact to Mr. Rifkin's satisfaction.
"Well, okay," said Mr. Rifkin. "Go ahead. I was just out in the driveway having a few beers and making a for sale sign to put up in the window of my car. You're not by any chance in the market for a 1981 Thunderbird?"
"I'm afraid not,"
said Fallow with a chortle, as if Mr. Rifkin were one of the great Saturday afternoon wits of his experience.
"Actually, I'm calling to inquire about one of your students, a young Mr. Henry Lamb."
"Henry Lamb? Doesn't ring a bell. What's he done?"
"Oh, he hasn't done anything. He's been seriously injured."
He proceeded to lay out the facts of the case, stacking them rather heavily toward the Albert Vogel Reverend Bacon theory of the incident.
"I was told he was a student in your English class."
"Who told you that?"
"His mother. I had quite a long talk with her. She's a very nice woman and very upset, as you can imagine."
"Henry Lamb."
"Oh, yes. I know what you mean. Well, that's too bad. What I would like to find out, Mr. Rifkin, is what kind of student Henry Lamb is."
"What kind?"
"Well, would you say he was an outstanding student?"
"Where are you from, Mr.—"
"I'm sorry, tell me your name again."
"Fallow.
Mr. Fallow, I gather you're not from New York."
"That's true."
"Then there's no reason why you should know anything about Colonel Jacob Rupert High School in the Bronx. At Rupert, we use comparative terms, but outstanding isn't one of them. The range runs more from cooperative to life-threatening." Mr. Rifkin began to chuckle.
"For Christ's sake, don't say I said that."
"Well, how would you describe Henry Lamb?" cooperative. He's a nice fellow. Never gives me any trouble. Would you describe him as a good student? Good doesn't work too well at Rupert either. It's more, does he attend class or doesn't he?
Did Henry Lamb attend class?
As I recall, yes, he's usually there. He's very dependable. He's a nice kid, as nice as they come.
Was there any part of the curriculum he was particularly good, or let me say, adept at? Anything he did better than anything else?
Not particularly.
No.
It's difficult to explain, Mr. Fellow. As the saying goes, ex nihilo nihil fit. There's not a great range of activities in these classes, and so it's hard to compare performances. These boys and girls, sometimes their minds are in the classroom and sometimes they're not.
What about Henry Lamb?
He's a nice fellow. He's polite, he pays attention, he doesn't give me any trouble. He tries to learn.
Well, he must have some abilities. His mother told me he was considering going to college.
That may well be. She's probably talking about CCNY. That's the City College of New York.
I believe Mrs. Lamb did mention that.
City College has an open admissions policy. If you live in New York City and you're a high school graduate and you want to go to City College, you can go.
Will Henry Lamb graduate, or would he have?
As far as I know. As I say, he has a very good attendance record.
How do you think he would have fared as a college student?
A sigh. I don't know. I can't imagine what happens with these kids when they enter City College.
Well, Mr. Rifkin, can you tell me anything at all about Henry Lamb's performance or his aptitude? Anything at all?
You have to understand that they give me about 65 students in each class when the year starts because they know it'll be down to 40 by mid-year and 30 by the end of the year. Even 30's too many, but that's what I get. It's not exactly what you'd call a tutorial system. Henry Lamb's a nice young man who applies himself and wants an education. What more can I tell you?
Let me ask you this. How does he do on his written work?
Mr. Rifkin let out a whoop.
Written work? There hasn't been any written work at Rupert High for 15 years. Maybe 20. They take multiple choice tests, reading comprehension. That's the big thing. That's all the Board of Education cares about.
How was Henry Lamb's reading comprehension? I'd have to look it up. Not bad, if I had to guess.
Better than most? Or about average? Or what would you say?
Well, I know it must be difficult for you to understand, Mr. Fellow, being from England. Am I right? You're British?
Yes, I am.
Naturally, or I guess it's natural, you're used to levels of excellence and so forth, but these kids haven't reached the level where it's worth emphasizing the kind of comparisons you're talking about. We're just trying to get them up to a certain level and then keep them from falling back. You're thinking about honor students and higher achievers and all that, and that's natural enough, as I say. But at Colonel Jacob Rupert High School, an honor student is somebody who attends class, isn't disruptive, tries to learn, and does all right at reading and arithmetic.
Well, let's use that standard. By that standard, is Henry Lamb an honor student?
By that standard, yes.
Thank you very much, Mr. Rifkin.
That's okay. I'm sorry to hear about all this. Seems like a nice boy. We're not supposed to call them boys, but that's what they are. Poor, sad, confused boys with a whole lot of problems. Don't quote me, for Christ's sake, or I'll have a whole lot of problems. Hey, listen, you sure you couldn't use a 1981 Thunderbird?
Chapter 10 Saturday's Saturnine Lunchtime. At that moment, also on Long Island, but 60 miles to the east on the South Shore, the Beach Club had just opened for the season. The club owned a low, rambling stucco building athwart the dunes and about 100 yards of beachfront, bounded by 2 dock ropes threaded through metal stanchions. The club facilities were spacious and comfortable, but were maintained devoutly in the Brahmin ascetic or boarding school scrubbed wood mode that had been fashionable in the 1920s and 1930s. So it was that Sherman McCoy now sat on the deck at a perfectly plain wooden table under a large faded umbrella. With him were his father, his mother, Judy, and, intermittently, Campbell. You could step, or in Campbell's case, run, directly from the deck onto the sand that lay between the two ropes, and Campbell was just now somewhere out there with Raleigh Thorpe's little girl Eliza and Garland Reed's little girl Mackenzie. Sherman was attentively not listening to his father tell Judy how Talbot, the club's bartender, had made his martini, which was the color of pale tea.
"No, why, but I've always preferred a martini made with sweet vermouth, shaken until it foams. Talbot always gives me an argument."
His father's thin lips were opening and closing, and his noble chin was going up and down, and his charming raconteur's smile was wrinkling his cheeks. Once, when Sherman was Campbell's age, his father and mother had taken him for a picnic out on the sand beyond the ropes. There was a spirit of adventure about this excursion. They were roughing it. The strangers out there on the sand, the handful who remained in the late afternoon, turned out to be harmless. Now Sherman let his eyes slide off his father's face to explore the sand beyond the ropes again. It made him squint, because where the cluster of tables and umbrellas ended, the beach was sheer dazzling light. So he shortened his range and found himself focusing on a head at the table just behind his father. It was the unmistakable round head of Pollard Browning. Pollard was sitting there with Lewis Sanderson the elder, who had always been Ambassador Sanderson when Sherman was growing up, and Mrs. Sanderson and Coker Channing and his wife. How Channing had ever become a member was beyond Sherman, except that he made a career of ingratiating himself with people like Pollard. Pollard was president of the club. Christ, he was president of Sherman's co-op board, too. That dense round head. But given his current frame of mind, Sherman was reassured by the sight of it. Dense as a rock, solid as a rock, rich as Croesus, immovable. His father's lips stopped moving for an instant, and he heard his mother say, "Dear, don't bore Judy with martinis. It makes you sound so old. Nobody but you drinks them any longer."
"Here at the beach they do. If you don't believe me,
it's like talking about flappers or rumble seats or dining cars or, if you don't believe me, K-rations or the hit parade. If you don't believe me, did you ever hear of a singer named Bonnie Baker?" She directed this at Judy, ignoring Sherman's father. "Bonnie Baker was the star of the hit parade on the radio. Wee Bonnie Baker, she was called. The entire country used to listen to her. Totally forgotten now, I expect." 65 years old and still beautiful, thought Sherman. Tall, lean, erect, thick white hair, refused to color it. An aristocrat, much more of one than his father, with all his dedication to being one, and still chipping away at the base of the statue of the great lion of Dunning Spunget. "Oh, you don't have to go back that far," said Judy. "I was talking to Garland's son Landrum. He's a junior, I think he said, at Brown." "Garland Reed has a son in college? Sally's son. Oh, dear, I'd totally forgotten about Sally. Isn't that awful?" "Not awful. Up to date," said Judy, without much of a smile.
"If you don't believe me, ask Talbot," said Sherman's father.
"Up to date," said his mother, laughing and ignoring the lion and his martinis and his Talbot. "Anyway," said Judy, "I happened to say something to him about hippies, and he just stared at me, never heard of them. Ancient history."
"Here at the beach..."
"Like martinis," Sherman's mother said to Judy.
"Here at the beach, you're still permitted to enjoy life's simple pleasures," said Sherman's father. "Or you were until a moment ago."
"Daddy and I went to that little restaurant in Wainscot last night, Sherman, the one Daddy liked so much, with Inez and Herbert Clark, and you know what the owner said to me? You know the pretty little woman who owns it?"
Sherman nodded yes.
"I find her very jolly," said his mother. "As we were leaving, she said to me, 'Well, first, I must mention that Inez and Herbert had 2 gin and tonics apiece. Daddy had his 3 martinis, and there was wine.' And she said to me,
'Celeste, your nose is growing. I had 1.
"Well, perhaps not 3. 2.
"Celeste.
"Well, she thought it was a lot, the owner did. She said to me, 'I like my older customers best of all. They're the only ones who drink anymore.' My older customers? I can't imagine how she thought that was supposed to sound to me."
"She thought you were 25. Said Sherman's father. Then to Judy, "All of a sudden I'm married to a white ribbon."
"A white ribbon?"
"More ancient history," he muttered. "Or else I'm married to Miss Trendy. You always have been up to date, Celeste.
Only compared to you, darling.
She smiled and put her hand on his forearm. I wouldn't take away your martinis for the world. Talbot's either.
I'm not worried about Talbot, said the lion.
Sherman had heard his father talk about how he liked his martinis mixed at least 100 times, and Judy must have heard it 20, but that was all right. It got on his mother's nerves, not his. It was comfortable. Everything was the same as always. That was the way he wanted things this weekend. The same, the same, the same, and neatly bounded by the two ropes. Just getting out of the apartment where "May I speak to Maria" still poisoned the air had helped considerably. Judy had driven out early yesterday afternoon in the station wagon with Campbell, Bonita, and Miss Lyons, the nanny. He had driven out last night in the Mercedes. This morning, in the driveway outside the garage behind their big old house on Old Drover's Mooring Lane, he had gone over the car in the sunlight. No evidence at all that he could detect of the fracas. Everything was brighter this morning, including Judy. She had chatted quite amiably at the breakfast table. Just now she was smiling at his father and mother. She looked relaxed, and really rather pretty, rather chic, in her polo shirt and pale yellow Shetland sweater and white slacks. She wasn't young, but she did have the kind of fine features that would age well. Lovely hair. The dieting and the abominable sports training, and age, had taken their toll on her breasts, but she still had a trim little body, firm. He felt a mild tingle. Perhaps tonight, or the middle of the afternoon. Why not? That might give the thaw, the rebirth of spring, the return of the sun, a more solid foundation. If she would agree, then the ugly business would be over. Perhaps all the ugly business would be over. 4 days had now passed, and there had not been a shred of news about anything dreadful happening to a tall, skinny boy on an expressway ramp in the Bronx. No one had come knocking at his door. Besides, she was driving. She had put it that way herself, and whatever happened, he was morally correct. Nothing to fear from God. He had been fighting for his life and for hers. Maybe the whole thing was one of God's warnings. Why didn't he and Judy and Campbell get out of the madness of New York and the megalomania of Wall Street? Who but an arrogant fool would want to be a master of the universe and take the insane chances he had been taking? A close call. Dear God, I swear to you that from now on... Why didn't they sell the apartment and move out here to Southampton year-round? Or to Tennessee? Tennessee. His grandfather, William Sherman McCoy, had come to New York from Knoxville when he was 31, a hick in the eyes of the Brownings. Well, what was so wrong with good American hicks? Sherman's father had taken him to Knoxville. He had seen the perfectly adequate house where his grandfather had grown up, a lovely little city, a sober, reasonable little city, Knoxville. Why didn't he go there and get a job in a brokerage house, a regular job, a sane, responsible job, not trying to spin the world on its head, a 9-to-5 job? Or whenever it is they work in places like Knoxville, $90,000 or $100,000 a year, a tenth or less of what he so foolishly thought he needed now, and it would be plenty. A Georgian house with a screen porch at one end, an acre or two of good green lawn, a snapper lawnmower that he might operate himself occasionally, a garage with a door that opens with a genie that you keep clipped onto the visor of your car, a kitchen with a magnetic bulletin board where you leave messages for each other, a cozy life, a loving life, our town. Judy was now smiling at something his father had said, and the lion was smiling in pleasure at her appreciation of his wit, and his mother was smiling at both of them. And at the tables beyond, Pollard was smiling, and Raleigh was smiling, and Ambassador Sanderson, his lanky old legs and all, was smiling. And the sweet sun of early June by the sea warmed Sherman's bones, and he relaxed for the first time in 2 weeks, and he smiled at Judy and his father and his mother as if he had actually been paying attention to their banter.
"Daddy!" Campbell came running toward him from out of the sand and the dazzling light onto the deck between the tables.
"Daddy!"
She looked absolutely glorious. Now almost 7 years old, she had lost her babyish features and was a little girl with slender arms and legs and firm muscles and not a blemish anywhere. She was wearing a pink bathing suit with the letters of the alphabet printed on it in black and white. Her skin glowed with sun and exercise. The very sight of her, of this vision, brought smiles to the faces of his father and his mother and Judy. He pivoted his legs out from under the table and opened his arms. He wanted her to run straight into his embrace. But she stopped short. She hadn't come for affection.
"Daddy!"
She was breathing hard. She had an important question.
"Daddy!"
"Yes, darling."
"Daddy!"
She could scarcely get her breath. "Take it easy, sweetheart. What is it?"
"Daddy, what do you do?"
What did he do? "Do? What do you mean, sweetheart?"
"Well, Mackenzie's daddy makes books and he has 80 people working for him."
"That's what Mackenzie told you?"
"Yes."
"Oh-ho, 80 people,"
said Sherman's father in the voice he used for small children. "My, my, my." Sherman could imagine what the lion thought of Garland Reed. Garland had inherited his father's printing business and for 10 years had done nothing with it but keep it alive. The books he made were printing jobs given him by the actual publishers, and the products were as likely to be manuals, club rosters, corporate contracts, and annual reports as anything even remotely literary. As for the 80 people, 80 ink-stained wretches was more like it, typesetters, pressmen, and so forth. At the height of his career, the Lion had had 200 Wall Street lawyers under his whip, most of them Ivy League.
"But what do you do?"
asked Campbell, now growing impatient. She wanted to get back to Mackenzie to give her report, and something impressive was clearly called for.
"Well, Sherman, how about it?"
said his father with a big grin. "I want to hear the answer to this myself. I've often asked myself what it is you fellas do exactly.
Campbell, that's an excellent question."
Campbell smiled, taking her grandfather's praise at face value. More irony, and not so welcome this time. The Lion had always resented his going into the bond business instead of the law, and the fact that he had prospered at it only made things worse. Sherman began to feel angry. He couldn't sit here and present a picture of himself as a master of the universe, not with his father and mother and Judy hanging on every word. At the same time, he couldn't give Campbell some modest depiction of himself as a salesman, one among many, or even as the chief bond salesman, which would sound pompous without sounding impressive and wouldn't mean anything to Campbell in any case. Campbell, who stood there panting, primed to race back to her little friend who had a daddy who made books and had 80 people working for him. "Well, I deal in bonds, sweetheart. I buy them, I sell them, I..."
"What are bonds? What is deal?"
Now his mother began laughing.
"You've got to do better than that, Sherman."
"Well, honey, bonds are... A bond is... Well, let me see. What's the best way to explain it to you?"
"Explain it to me, too, Sherman," said his father. "I must have done 5,000 leverage purchase contracts, and I always fell asleep before I could figure out why anyone wanted the bonds."
"That's because you and your 200 Wall Street lawyers were nothing but functionaries for the masters of the universe," thought Sherman, getting more annoyed by the second. He saw Campbell looking at her grandfather in consternation. "Your grandfather's only joking, honey." He shot his father a sharp look. "A bond is a way of loaning people money. Let's say you want to build a road, and it's not a little road but a big highway, like the highway we took up to Maine last summer, or you want to build a big hospital. Well, that requires a lot of money, more money than you could ever get by just going to a bank. So what you do is you issue what are called bonds."
"You build roads and hospitals, Daddy? That's what you do?"
Now both his father and his mother started laughing. He gave them openly reproachful looks, which only made them merrier. Judy was smiling with what appeared to be a sympathetic twinkle.
"No, I don't actually build them, sweetheart. I handle the bonds, and the bonds are what make it possible."
"You help build them?"
"Well, in a way."
"Which ones?"
"Which ones?"
You said roads and hospitals.
Well, not any one specifically.
The road to Maine?
Now both his father and mother were giggling the infuriating giggle of people who are trying their best not to laugh right in your face.
No, not the... I think you're in over your head, Sherman, said his mother.
Head came close to soaring into a whoop.
Not the road to Maine, said Sherman, ignoring the comment.
Let me try to put it another way, Judy broke in.
Let me try.
Well, all right.
Darling, said Judy, Daddy doesn't build roads or hospitals, and he doesn't help build them, but he does handle the bonds for the people who raise the money.
Bonds?
Yes. Just imagine that a bond is a slice of cake, and you didn't bake the cake, but every time you hand somebody a slice of the cake, a tiny little bit comes off like a little crumb, and you can keep that.
Judy was smiling, and so was Campbell, who seemed to realize that this was a joke, a kind of fairy tale based on what her daddy did.
Little crumbs?
She said encouragingly.
Yes, said Judy. Or you have to imagine little crumbs, but a lot of little crumbs. If you pass around enough slices of cake, then pretty soon you have enough crumbs to make a gigantic cake. For real life? Asked Campbell.
No, not for real life. You just have to imagine that. Judy looked to Sherman's father and mother for approval of this witty description of the bond business. They smiled, but uncertainly.
I'm not sure you're making it any clearer for Campbell, said Sherman. My goodness, crumbs!
He smiled to show he knew this was only lunch-table banter. In fact, he was used to Judy's supercilious attitude toward Wall Street, but he was not happy about crumbs.
I don't think it's such a bad metaphor, said Judy, also smiling.
Then she turned to his father. Let me give you an actual example, John, and you be the judge.
John?
Even though there was something off about crumbs, this was the first real indication that things might be going over the edge. John? His father and mother had encouraged Judy to call them John and Celeste, but it made her uncomfortable. So she avoided calling them anything. This casual, confident John was not like her. Even his father appeared a bit on guard. Judy launched into a description of his Giscard scheme. Then she said to his father,
Pierce and Pierce doesn't issue them for the French government and doesn't buy them from the French government, but from whoever's already bought them from the French government. So Pierce and Pierce transactions have nothing to do with anything France hopes to build or develop or achieve. It's all been done long before Pierce and Pierce enters the picture. So they're just sort of slices of cake, golden cake. And Pierce and Pierce collects millions of marvelous, she shrugged, golden crumbs.
You can call them crumbs if you want, said Sherman, trying not to sound testy and failing.
Well, that's the best I can do, Judy said brightly.
Then to his father and mother,
investment banking is an unusual field. I don't know if there is any way you can explain it to anyone under 20, or perhaps under 30.
Sherman now noticed that Campbell was standing by with a distressed look on her face.
Campbell, he said, you know what? I think Mommy wants me to change professions.
He grinned as if this were one of the funniest discussions in years.
Not at all, said Judy, laughing. I'm not complaining about your golden crumbs.
Crumbs. Enough. He could feel his anger rising, but he kept on smiling.
Perhaps I ought to try decorating. Excuse me, interior designing.
I don't think you're cut out for it.
Oh, I don't know. It must be fun getting poof curtains and polished chintz for... Who were those people, those Italians you did that apartment for? The Deducci's?
I don't know that it's fun, particularly.
Well, then it's creative, right?
Well, at least you're able to point to something you've done, something tangible, something clear-cut, for the Deducci's. Even if it's for people who are shallow and vain, it's something real, something describable, something contributing to simple human satisfaction, no matter how meretricious and temporary, something you can at least explain to your children. I mean, at Pierce and Pierce, what on earth do you tell each other you do every day?
All at once, a wail, Campbell. Tears were coming down her face. Sherman put his arms around her, but her body was rigid.
"It's all right, sweetie."
Judy got up and came over and put her arms around her, too.
"Oh, Campbell, 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 sweetie pie, Daddy and I were only teasing each other."
Pollard Browning was looking their way. So was Raleigh. Faces at tables all around, staring at the wounded child. Because they were both trying to embrace Campbell, Sherman found his face close to Judy's. He wanted to strangle her. He glanced at his parents. They were aghast. His father stood up.
"I'm going to get a martini," he said. "You're all too up to date for me."
Saturday, in Soho. After a wait of less than 20 minutes, Larry Kramer and his wife Rhoda, and Greg Rosenwald and his live-in girlfriend Mary Lou, Love Greg, and Herman Rappaport and his wife Susan, now occupied a window table at the Haiphong Harbor restaurant. Outside on West Broadway, it was such a clear, sparkling late spring day that not even the grime of Soho could obscure it. Not even Kramer's envy of Greg Rosenwald could obscure it. He and Greg and Herman had been classmates at New York University. They had worked on the student activities board together. Herman was now an editor, one among many, at Putnam, the publishing house, and it was largely thanks to him that Rhoda had gotten her job at Waverly Place Books. Kramer was an assistant district attorney, one among 245 in the Bronx. But Greg, with his downtown clothes on and the lovely Mary Lou blonde at his side, was a writer for the Village Voice. So far, Greg was the only star that had risen from their little group of campus hotshots. That had been apparent from the moment they sat down. Any time the others had a comment to make, they looked at Greg when they made it. Herman was looking at Greg when he said, "Have you been in this place, Dean and DeLuca? Have you checked out the prices? Smoked, Scottish, salmon, $33 a pound. Susan and I were just in there." Greg smiled knowingly.
"That's for the Short Hill Seville set."
"The Short Hill Seville set?"
asked Rhoda. "My wife, the perfect foil." Not only that, she had the kind of grin on her face that you put on when you just know you're going to get a witty reply.
"Yeah," said Greg. "Take a look at it."
His accent was as atrocious as Rhoda's.
"Every other car is a Cadillac Seville with Jersey license plates, and take a look at what they wear."
Not only did he have an atrocious accent, he had the 300-watt animation of David Brenner, the comedian.
"They roll out of these six-bedroom Georgians in Short Hills with Obama jackets and blue jeans, and they get in their Cadillac Sevilles, and they drive to Soho every Saturday."
But Rhoda and Herman and Susan beamed and chuckled in appreciation. They thought this was rich stuff. Only Mary Lou blonde headlights looked less than swept away by this priceless urbanity. Kramer decided that if he got a word in edgewise, he would direct it toward her. Greg was off on a disquisition on all the bourgeois elements who were now attracted to the artist's quarter. Why didn't he start with himself? Look at him. A wavy red beard as big as the King of Hearts's, hiding his receding chin. A blackish-green tweed jacket with enormous shoulders and lapels with notches down around his ribs. A black T-shirt with a logo of the Puss Casserole, the band, across the chest. Black pegged pants, the greasy black look that was so post-punk, so downtown, so of the moment. And in fact, he was a nice little Jewish boy from Riverdale, which was the Short Hills of the New York City limits, and his parents had a nice big colonial house or Tudor or whatever it was, a middle-class twerp, a writer for the Village Voice, a know-it-all, possessor of Mary Lou Downey Shanks. Greg had started living with Mary Lou when she enrolled in the investigative journalism seminar he was teaching at NYU 2 years ago. She had a fantastic body, outstanding breasts, and classic WASP looks. She stood out on the NYU campus like somebody from another planet. Kramer called her Mary Lou Love Greg, which was a way of saying she had given up her actual identity to live with Greg. She bothered them. She bothered Kramer most of all. He found her dense, distant, intensely desirable. She reminded him of the girl with brown lipstick. And for this, he envied Greg most of all. He had taken this gorgeous creature and possessed her, without assuming any obligations, without getting stuck in an ant colony on the west side, without having an English nanny sitting on his neck, without having a wife he had to watch turning into her shtetl mama. Kramer caught a look at Rhoda and her beaming, puffy face and immediately felt guilty. He loved his new son. He was bound to Rhoda forever in a sacred way, and yet, this is New York, and I'm young. Greg's words flowed past him. His eyes wandered. For a moment, they met Mary Lou's. She held them. Could it be? But he couldn't look at her forever. He looked out the window at the people walking along West Broadway. Most were young or youngish. So smartly turned out, so downtown, sparkling, even in greasy black, on a perfect Saturday in late spring. Then and there, sitting at a table in the Haiphong Harbor, Kramer vowed that he would be part of it. The girl with brown lipstick had held his eyes, and he had held hers when the verdict came. He had won. He had carried the jury and sunk Herbert, who would get a sentence of 3 to 6 at the very least, since he already had a felony conviction on his record. He had been tough, fearless, shrewd, and he had won. He had won her. When the foreman, a black man named Forrester, had announced the verdict, he had looked into her eyes, and she had looked into his, and they had stayed that way for what seemed like a very long time. There was no question about it. Kramer tried to catch Mary Lou's eyes again, but missed. Rhoda was looking at the menu. He heard her ask Susan Rappaport,
"Cheat for you came down here?"
Which meant, "Did you eat before you came down here?" Susan said,
"No, Joe."
"No, did you?"
"No, I couldn't wait to get out of the house. I won't be able to do this again for 16 years. "Do what?" "Oh, just go to Soho because I feel like going to Soho. Go anywhere. The baby nurse is leaving on Wednesday." "Why don't you get somebody else?" "Are you kidding? You want to know how much we're paying her?" "How much?" $525 a week. My mother's been paying for it for 4 weeks.
"Thanks a lot. Go ahead. Tell all these yentas your husband can't even afford the goddamn baby nurse." He noticed that Susan's eyes left Rhoda's face and looked up. On the sidewalk, just on the other side of the plate glass, stood a young man trying to peer in. If it hadn't been for the quarter inch of plate glass, he would have been leaning right across their table. He kept peering, 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 until the tip of his nose was almost pressed against the glass. Now all 6 of them were looking at the fellow, but he apparently couldn't see them. He had a lean, lineless, fair young face and soft, curly, light brown hair. In his open-neck shirt, with the collar of his navy warm-up jacket turned up, he looked like a young aviator from long ago. Mary Lou Caress turned toward Susan with a mischievous look on her face.
"I think we ought to ask him if he's had lunch."
Said Susan, who, like Rhoda, had already laid on her first subcutaneous layer of matron.
"He looks hungry to me," said Mary Lou.
"Looks retarded to me," said Greg.
Greg was scarcely a foot away from the young man, and the contrast between Greg's unhealthy, greasy black, downtown, hip weasel appearance and the young man's rosy good looks was overwhelming. Kramer wondered if the others noticed. Mary Lou must have noticed. This red-bearded Riverdale twerp didn't deserve her. Kramer caught her eye again for a moment, but she watched the young man, who, baffled by the reflections, now turned away from the window and began walking up West Broadway. On the back of his jacket was embroidered a golden thunderbolt, and above it the words, "Radartronic Security."
"Radartronic Security,"
said Greg in a way that indicated what a cipher, a nullity, was this character Mary Lou had decided to go gaga over.
"You can be sure he doesn't work for any security company," said Kramer.
He was determined to capture Mary Lou's attention.
"Why not?" said Greg.
"Because I happen to know who does. I see them every day." I wouldn't hire a security guard in this city if my life depended on it. Especially if my life depended on it. They're all predicate violent felons.
They're what?
Asked Mary Lou. Predicate violent felons. They already have at least one conviction for a felony involving violence against a person.
Oh, come on, said Herman. That can't be true.
He had their attention now. He was playing his one strong suit, macho insider from the Bronx.
Well, not all, but I bet 60%. You ought to sit in on the plea bargaining session some morning up on the Grand Concourse. One of the ways you justify a plea bargain is the judge asks the defendant if he has a job, and if he does, that's supposed to show he has roots in the community and so on. So the judge will ask these kids if they have a job. And I mean, these kids are being held for armed robbery, muggings, assaults, manslaughter, attempted murder, you name it. And every one of them, if they have any job at all, they'll say, yeah, security guard. I mean, who do you think takes these jobs? They pay minimum wage, they're boring, and when they're not boring, they're unpleasant.
Maybe they're good at it, said Greg. They like to mix it up. They know how to handle weapons.
Rhoda and Susan laughed. Such a wit, such a wit. Mary Lou didn't laugh. She kept looking at Kramer.
No doubt they do, he said.
He didn't want to lose control of the conversation and those big-breasted blue eyes. Everybody in the Bronx carries weapons. Let me tell you about a case I just finished.
Ah.
This was his chance to tell about the triumph of the people over that desperado Herbert 92X, and he plunged into the story with relish. But from the first, Greg caused problems. As soon as he heard the name Herbert 92X, he butted in with some story he had done on prisons for the Village Voice.
If it weren't for the Muslims, the prisons in this city would really be out of control.
That was bullshit, but Kramer didn't want the discussion to get onto the Muslims and Greg's goddamn story, so he said, Herbert's not really a Muslim. I mean, Muslims don't go to bars. It was slow going. Greg knew it all. He knew all about Muslims, prisons, crime, street life in the billion-footed city. He began to turn the story against Kramer. Why were they so anxious to prosecute a man who had done nothing but follow the natural instinct to protect your own life? But he killed a man, Greg, with an unlicensed gun that he carried every day as a routine thing.
Yeah, but look at the job he had. It's obviously a dangerous occupation. You said yourself everybody carries weapons up there.
Look at his job?
Okay, let's look at it. He works for a goddamn bootlegger. What do you want him to do, work for IBM?
You talk like that's out of the question. I bet IBM has plenty of programs for minorities. But Herbert wouldn't want one of their jobs if they gave it to him. Herbert is a player. He's a hustler who tries to cover himself with this religious mantle, and he just goes on being childish, egocentric, irresponsible, shiftless.
Suddenly it dawned on Kramer that they were all looking at him in a funny way, all of them. Rhoda, Mary Lou. They were giving him the look you give someone who turns out to be a covert reactionary. He was too far gone in this criminal justice scam. He was humming with the system's reactionary overtones. This was like one of the bull sessions the gang used to have when they were all back at NYU. Except that now they were in their early 30s, and they were looking at him as if he had become something awful. And he knew, in an instant, there was no way he could explain to them what he had seen over the past 6 years. They wouldn't understand, least of all Greg, who was taking his triumph over Herbert 92X and stuffing it down his throat. It was going so badly that Rhoda felt compelled to come to the rescue.
You don't understand, Greg, she said. You have no idea the caseload Larry has. There are 7,000 criminal indictments every year in the Bronx, and they only have the capacity for 500 trials. There's no way you can study every aspect of every case and take all these different things into consideration.
I can just imagine somebody trying to tell that to this fellow, Herbert 92X.
Kramer looked up at the ceiling of the Haiphong Harbor. It had been painted matte black, along with all sorts of ducts, pipes, and lighting fixtures. Looked like intestines. His own wife. Her idea of coming to his defense was to say, Larry's got so many colored people to put away, he hasn't got time to treat them as individuals, so you mustn't be hard on him.
He had broken his hump on the Herbert 92X case, handled it brilliantly, looked Herbert himself right in the eye, avenged the father of five, Nestor Cabrillo, and what did he get for it? Now he had to defend himself against a bunch of intellectual trendies in a trendy bistro in trendy fucking Soho. He scanned the table. Even Mary Lou was giving him the fishy look. The big, beautiful white bread air had